I think a leader's job is to continually disrupt with the view of evolving their team or their business to meet the needs of their future customer. You know, to improve is to change. So to change something requires an element of disruption. It could be a huge amount of disruption. It could be a small amount of disruption, but there's always disruption. Great leaders are disruptors, but they only ever disrupt to move forwards with the intention of growth.
Hello, and welcome to Infinite Pi Thinking with me, Al Fawcett. Joining me in some thought-provoking conversation today is Charlie Sampson, an executive coach, co-founder of several other leadership and development businesses, author of the business book Even Better If, and as you'll hear, so much more. Charlie shares his thoughts and perspective on leadership, management, coaching and communication, and where they overlap and where they differ. We explore how the lessons from his own background and experience, coupled with all the research and the working he's done with others, has helped him to shape his passion and enthusiasm for supporting others to make an impact. So take a listen and let me know what you think. Charlie, welcome to the Infinite Pi Thinking Podcast.
Al, good morning. Thank you.
Charlie, lots to discuss, lots to cover, but what I want to do is I want to get to know you a little bit more. So some background and, if you like, the origin story of Charlie Sampson. But let me ask you it in this way and ask you to think about one or two pivotal moments in your life or career that have brought you to where you are now.
Blimey. Okay. So I had a weird transition into kind of what I'm doing now and have been doing for, I suppose, the last nearly 15 years now in terms of the kind of performance coaching leadership space. And I sort of fell into it almost by accident. So I did the uni thing, was really pushing to become a pro musician, guitar player. That was my passion, but was probably too lazy to really make it work. And ended up doing every job under the sun. I mean, really weird stuff, but it's funny how it's all sort of contributed to what I do now in a weird way. So I did really extreme things from, I was a runner on Top Gear. So I did a bit of motoring journalism, you know, working on building sites. I even did a bit of grave digging, would you believe it? And then, long story short, to your question about pivotal moments, I think the thing that sent me on my path to doing what I do now is I worked in the recruitment industry for a while, which I absolutely hated. It was pure, you know, sell, sell, sell. There was no customer service. Nobody cared about, you know, the kind of the end result. It was just money, money, money. And that taught me a lot. And as a result of that, I then got involved in a startup headhunting business, which actually sounds terrible, was actually a complete disaster. But it was the thing that sort of sent me off in the direction that I'm now in, because the bit I really enjoyed and loved about it was working with the clients and actually trying to figure out solutions that were right for them. The thing I didn't like about it was selling and just the kind of, never mind the product, it's all about the money. And that transitioned me then into, I took on an interim role with the police in an HR role, where I kind of completely by accident got involved in running things like their performance management. And I was quite good at it. And that gave me a taste for that. And then the really pivotal bit for me, I guess my first, I suppose, respectable corporate role was with Orange. And I was living in Bristol at the time. And again, as I have a habit of doing, I sort of worked my way into and found my way into a role looking after things like exec development. So I had no qualifications or kind of justification for being able to do that. I just believed that I could help people and was quite good at it. And that's really where I hadn't heard of coaching up until that point. It wasn't a thing I'd really come across. And that was really my introduction to it. And then, you know, move on and on and on, made a move out to Dubai for various reasons, which was the best thing I ever did in terms of getting exposure to just other cultures, global practice, you know, working for multinational organizations. So I did a stint with HSBC, which was just a brilliant education in terms of what happens in big business, in really big business, all the nonsense, the politics, the egos, the fun, the great stuff. I mean, just the best education, university education in executive development you could ever have. And as a result of that, I ended up starting my first coaching business. And I was incredibly lucky because I left HSBC and then actually worked for HSBC as a consultant for the best part of a couple of years. So I didn't have that horrible kind of looking over the cliff edge. I'm starting a business. Where's the money going to come from? You know, banging the phones and all of that. It wasn't nearly as bad as that. So I was incredibly lucky to have that relationship. And it just snowballed from there. So I moved back to the UK about 8 years ago, brought the business back, and have subsequently started and really kind of got off the ground two other businesses that are very linked to the whole, you know, human development, human performance And yeah, I live down not a million miles from you, Al, down on the Devon Somerset border on a what was an old sheep farm. It's now a retired farm. And one of the bolt-ons to the, one of the things I do is a really successful holiday let business. And we do sometimes use that for leadership retreats and corporate weekends where we do a lot of deep immersion into leadership and coaching masterclasses and all that good stuff, which I absolutely love. So I feel very fortunate.
Wow, fantastic. So you said that you fell into it by accident. So you didn't want to be an executive coach when you were a kid? What do I want to be when I grow up in careers lessons?
I wanted to be a rock star when I was a kid. So my dad was a professional musician when he was younger, which is probably where I got it from. And I remember my dad sitting down one day and saying to me, he said, "You're just not hungry enough." And he was absolutely right. Absolutely right. So I loved it, but wasn't hungry enough to, you know, to kind of be completely poverty stricken for, you know, 10 years and do anything that it took to
even though you work. Dug graves and various other bits and pieces.
Well, yeah, quite. But I mean, we can get really sidetracked. I feel because obviously I've got young kids, and I feel very strongly. I find it very frustrating when this whole emphasis on teenagers, and I've done quite a lot of coaching with adolescents, and it's maybe something we could talk about later on, but it's been fascinating around things like, you know, the brain development of adolescents, and the idea of saying to somebody when they're 17 or 18, "So what do you want to do with your life?" is such nonsense. And it really frustrates me. I mean, you get the occasional kid who kind of may think, you know what? And you get the traditional vocational things around, you know, legal, health, doctors, all the rest of it. But who knows? I literally hadn't worked any of this out. Didn't have a clue what I wanted to be until I was probably certainly in my early 30s, latest.
Yeah. No, I'm still thinking about it. So I love that. Look, there was lots of stuff that you covered in there that I feel really interesting. And I get the whole bit about I wanted to be a musician, but I was too lazy. And I think that can apply in lots of different sort of aspects. And there's a difference between I would love to be and I love the idea of. And I think that that is something that a lot of people can sort of talk about. Ultimately, with a lot of these things, it's about doing the work. It's about putting the work in, putting the effort in. And then obviously the opportunities that come as a result of that, which sort of links me back to your career path where you said you got into doing some performance management type stuff with this organization. And then you started in this organization and you had no qualifications, but you got into the executive development space. You might not have had the qualifications, but you must have had something that others saw in you that went, yeah, safe pair of hands. We can leave him to do that because he's going to do a good job at it. So how did you go about that?
I would say that the thing that has always served me really well, and it's something that I just think is fundamental to, well, it's fundamental to leadership, but it's fundamental to anybody looking to get into the kind of executive development space, is curiosity. So the thing I've always had, for whatever reason, and still to this day, just as much as I ever have, is I'm really curious. I'm really curious about people, for instance. So if I sit and meet somebody, even if I'm sitting there and, you know, the imposter syndrome is just coming off me in waves because I'm thinking, you know, I'm having a performance management conversation with the chief superintendent, constable, whatever. And, you know, you're sort of faking it till you make it a bit. But the bit that immediately then comes through is if you're genuinely interested in the other person and you're curious, hey, now, how did you get to where you got to? You know, what's some of the stuff you do really well that's led to that point? You know, what are some of the things you want to do next? I think that's been the bit that has really made the difference, because curiosity, you know, not assuming I know anything, not assuming I know the answer, and therefore being more interested in somebody else's view on something, is the key to so many things from an organizational point of view. Part of that obviously is around listening. And it's a skill that is so neglected, and it's getting worse, to your point. We see this all the time on the academy business, that people come to us who are, you know, 20, 30 years experience, and they can't physically sit and listen to somebody for more than about 10 seconds before they want to tell them what they think about the world. So I think it's probably that was the bit that's helped me massively. And then obviously I've had to, like a duck with the kind of feet underwater, is kind of go like crazy to try and catch up with myself so that I've actually got something of value to offer.
I love that. It's brilliant though, because we can go on lots of courses and programs and read books and all the rest of it, and it says listening is a core skill, but then it spends about 6 minutes on it. So here are the three tricks to listen better. And it becomes the standard trope, doesn't it? You know, paraphrase and reply back and demonstrate your understanding and whatever, but it becomes all about you rather than them. And there's a tendency of we want to drive to solution really quickly. And we need to, in order to provide our credibility as managers or as leaders within business, I've got to demonstrate that I've got the answer. And the problem is you've got a 50-50 chance of being right or wrong, or at least the other person's perspective is, yeah, we tried that, it didn't work, blah, blah, blah.
Whereas if you ask a question, you can't be wrong, can you?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we always say jokingly, most people, and this is truer now than it's ever been, most people's default communication position is, how long do I have to listen to you for before I can tell you what I think? And it's true. And you see it every day. I despair sometimes, but clearly there's huge opportunity in that. It's partly the excuse for it is speed. You know, people will say, well, that's because we have to move at pace and we have to do things quicker. But that's just an excuse, because the end result is worse as a byproduct of that. So I think people let themselves off the hook in that respect. But yeah, it's true. It's sad, but true.
You mentioned that it was when you got into the executive development is when you started to first get insights into coaching as a principle and as a practice. So it's almost like a chicken and egg situation, but how do you see them fitting together? Is it coaching is part of leadership? Is it that you can't lead without being a good coach? Are the words interchangeable? Do they really matter? Does it matter what we call it as long as we get the outcomes? I mean, what's your perspective on all of that?
I don't think it does matter. I think coaching, the word coaching is very unhelpful, actually, because, well, for two reasons. One is everybody's now a coach. You know, look on LinkedIn, everybody's a coach suddenly. But the main reason, I think, is that because of the way coaching has come about, I mean, in the UK, coaching really kind of kicked off in the, I suppose, the late 80s, early 90s and became a thing. But the trouble is the way coaching's taught by most consultancies or organizations, it's very much process technique led. So it's seen as a thing you do. You know, we go into a room, a dark room, and we sit opposite a table and, you know, it's all quiet and there's no distractions and I'm now going to coach you. And the person who's doing the coaching suddenly becomes this peculiar animal asking weird questions that they wouldn't normally ask. And it just all feels a bit artificial and weird. And the problem with that, of course, is the person on the other end is getting really confused. So immediately you've built a brick wall to achieve the whole point of what you're trying to achieve. So I think the word coaching is very misconstrued. And actually, the way to think about coaching is just a fundamental shift in the way you communicate. It's not something you switch on and off. It's not something that you go, oh, here's an opportunity to coach. I now switch on my coaching hat or put on my coaching hat. It needs to be something that is just habitual and ingrained in the way you communicate all the time. I mean, curiosity plays a big part of that. But it's things like, you know, somebody asks you something, always have a question to understand better where are they at already with their thinking around that thing. You know, an obvious example would be if you're a boss and someone comes to you and says, what do I do with this? Is your instinct to immediately ask, well, where have you got to already with it? What have you come up with? You know, I mean, that sounds obvious, but so many people don't do that one simple thing. So I think it's partly that. It's partly being more challenging, I think, in your communication style, because we want people to think better. You know, we don't employ people not to think. And yet we often manage people in that way, which is just nonsense. Things like, I think, the kind of the listening skills. I mean, empathy has been talked a lot about particularly over the pandemic. I think it's been overbaked. I mean, I read something yesterday that said empathy is the number one leadership skill. And I mean, what a nonsense. You know, if all you do is empathize, you are not going to get much done. But it is a really, really important part of your communication style, back to being genuinely interested in people, trying to understand things from their perspective. You know, we talk about things like diversity and inclusion all the time. Well, diversity and inclusion is trying to understand fundamentally where someone else is at and how they see whatever they're disagreeing with you on. Can you do a 180, have the self-awareness to go, do you know what? I'm going to hold my belief gently. And for a minute, I'm going to explore it from a completely different perspective just to see, how do I find that? Do I still therefore believe what I did 5 minutes ago? So it's around all of those things that they all make up what I would call this thing called coaching. It's much, much more about communication. Therefore, very much the basis of anything around great leadership. You cannot be a great leader without having those communication skills in place. You just can't, particularly not in business.
Love that. Again, like you said, because that comes in various guises, doesn't it? I mean, it's how do you get across a vision? How do you get across values? How do you get across, this is the way we do things around here? How do you get across we can make this even better if, which is a tenuous link to something we'll cover off in a minute. How do we make this better and continue to develop and improve and evolve it and innovate it if we can't communicate that message in some way, shape, or form?
Absolutely. I mean, I think if you take the simple way of thinking about it, is take the view that, you know, when we communicate, when we work with people, we have to deal with people holistically. And what I mean by that is that too many people work with somebody based on their job. So I communicate with you as a job title. You're not a job title. You're a human being. Right. And we all have our hopes and fears and insecurities and, you know, BS and all the rest of it. What I want to do very quickly as a leader, as a boss, as anybody who's got any kind of people management responsibility or anyone who is involved in people development, is I've got to get through that wall. We talk about a suit of armor because we all have a certain suit of armor that we wear. I've got to get through that to understand the person first, because then I understand things like what motivates you, you know, what actually drives you, why are you different from other people? Not many people, partly because they haven't got the confidence to do it, but not many people will invest the time in doing that. To then, you know, to that's our starting point, and we work backwards to then think about things like obviously the role and responsibilities, etc. But we've got to work with people and communicate and deal with people as human beings, not as job titles. That's the thing.
And I used to do this thing at the beginning of meetings, again, from the introduction point of view, and whether it be a program I was delivering or whatever it might be. And when I was doing the, I want people to introduce, one of the things was, what's your job role? And the thing that was really interesting was going around the room, and I said job role, and yet most people gave me a job title.
Yeah.
And I would go back and afterwards and I'd say, you gave me a job title. I want a job role. I said, tell me your job role. And then they give me a job description.
Yeah.
I go, no. I want to know your purpose. Why are you here? What difference do you make? What meaning do you bring to this role? And so on and so forth. So that's really fascinating. But you've mentioned a number of times time. And you're absolutely right. You know, again, like I said, we both know that the managers always think it's quicker just to tell them what to do than it is to get them to explore it. But also even things like you just said there about understanding them as humans, understanding them as people. That's time as well, right? Because in my mind, I haven't got time to explore all that. I just want them to do a good job. And if I tell them what to do, then at least they know what to do, right? So how do you overcome that time thing when that's people's perception of getting to know the people?
Yeah, I think it's a good point, because time is a misconception. I think it's an excuse not to do something. But it just takes too long. You know, I can't do this coaching thing. It takes too long. Well, if you're really good at it, you can be incredibly effective in a conversation in 5 minutes. It doesn't have to take a long time. I think back to the time thing. I think in terms of what I said earlier about that sort of holistic view, and therefore the investment you'll make in understanding a bit more about somebody. I mean, you can have an incredible conversation in 30 minutes with somebody and really, really get into some stuff. It requires a certain amount of skill, though, from a communication point of view. A, to get somebody very quickly to a place where they feel safe enough, and there is an element of trust in the relationship for somebody to open up. And there is quite a lot of skill in doing that. But it doesn't have to take very long. But I think, again, it's back to that curiosity, isn't it? Because by doing that, sometimes by having a bit of a structure for what you're doing. So, for instance, if, I don't know, let's say you've just hired someone into the team and you sit with them as part of their induction, you would absolutely want to be investing probably an hour to explore with them their aspirations. You know, what are you hoping to get from this? Why did you come and join us? Too many people are still in that 1980s, 90s interview style of saying, well, where do you want to be in 3 years' time? And who knows? I don't really care. I want to know, what sort of fire have you got in your belly now? You know, what sort of energy have you got going on? What are some of the intentions you've got? And you can get into that stuff very quickly. I think once you've done it, once you've made that investment, you're not going to be having those conversations every week, because it's unnecessary and it would be really frustrating. But we've got to invest that time initially, and then all we're doing is checking in with people. You know, has anything changed? We talked about this 6 months ago. We got a few things written down. Has anything changed? Has anything moved on? Do I need to know anything that's different? And you're continually kind of building in then that feedback cycle. But it's extraordinary how many conversations we have that are just completely superficial.
Yeah.
And always remain at that level. Sometimes that's fine. But we can't always do that, you know, because, again, it makes me laugh. Everybody moans about time. The amount of time people waste in a day doing stuff that's completely meaningless and superficial. I mean, the conversations that go on. Yeah, okay, you need to have a chat and just collapse sometimes and be quite informal and have a coffee. That's fine. But the amount of time actually people build into their day, which is one of the reasons why I think virtual working has been difficult, because people now, when they're on screen and they're on their Zoom or their Teams or whatever, you haven't got that element, you know? So if you're doing 6 Zoom calls back to back in a day, you're absolutely knackered because you don't have that time to build in. But it's quite interesting that it demonstrates, actually, if it's done well, it demonstrates how much more gets done versus the physical environment, I think, where people can,
they can get distracted and pulled into. And again, it's fascinating, isn't it? Because, you know, we'll hear things like, I'm a people person. My people are the most important thing to me. So we can misconstrue that with, so therefore I need to be there for them when they want to moan or they want to tell me all the reasons why something won't work or they want to do all these things. And you mentioned the word challenge earlier, and it's that ability to be able to turn around and break that pattern of going, I get all that. So what do you want? What do we want to achieve as a result of this? What's the purpose of this conversation? What's going to be good for you as a result of having this? And it's, again, it's still a question. It's asking us the quality of the questions that we ask will determine the quality of the answers that we'll get. And again, it becomes that ability to be able to put a purpose to some of these conversations. But it's understanding what we're trying to do rather than, oh, I spend 15 minutes with all of my people in the morning just letting them get stuff off their chest. Well, you know, for what purpose?
I mean, I completely agree. I mean, it's sort of part of that thing I said earlier about coaching being a form of just great communication. So, you know, I think one of the things we have to do, certainly as a coach, but also as a leader, is you have to keep people moving forwards because nothing stands still. You know, everybody talks about change, but we've never not had change. It's just things have accelerated. So we've got to keep people moving forward. So the thing you said originally there is listening to someone moan. There is a time and a place for that.
Yeah.
What we don't want to do is fall into the trap of sympathy, though.
Yes.
There is no place for it in a business context. Sympathy is reinforcing someone's belief they are right to feel sorry for themselves. Now, that sounds harsh, but that's what sympathy does as an approach. And if I sympathize with you, I'm going to have to sympathize with you again. And you're going to come to me because you think I'm that person who's just going to sit and say, oh, Al, I'm really sorry to hear that. And yeah, you poor thing, that's really tough and da-da-da-da-da. That's not the same as empathy. Empathy is being warm and human and kind and giving someone a hug if they need a hug. But to your point, it's then saying, okay, how do we move you to a better place? How do we move you away from this situation? How do we move things forwards so that this starts to remedy itself? And that's very different.
Yes.
Because a big part of our job as great leaders and great coaches is helping people move from one state to another state. So we all have bad days. We all do need downtime. We all need time to wallow and feel sorry for ourselves. As human creatures, we need that. As long as there comes a point where we go, right, enough wallowing. I need to pull myself together and get on with it.
Yeah.
As long as that's happening, that's okay. But if we sympathize, we are delaying that moment of somebody saying, enough now, I need to move on. So we've got to be quite careful with those two things because that's not our job.
Well, exactly. And that's where states become traits. And we move from that, okay, I'm currently feeling like this to this is who I am. And I've even heard phrases like, oh, well, that's just John or that's just such and such. And then we're almost allowing that. We're almost like giving permission for that because we just accept that as who they are.
Absolutely.
And like you said, that's not about helping them to progress. And we're not helping them in any way, shape, or form as much as we feel we are by lending them an ear.
I mean, just if anyone's listening to this and thinking, I sound like a really unpleasant, horrible, hard, you know, sort of heartless person.
They're right.
They're correct. No. I mean, sympathy has its place in a bereavement. Obviously,
yes.
And things like that. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about people in a kind of day-to-day situation in a business context.
I mean, it's context, yeah.
You know, the challenging element, I mean, a classic example would be somebody who feels aggrieved by their boss. And so that starts to become ingrained. It starts to become a thing. If you sympathize with that individual, and this is often what friends and family will do because they think it's helpful. So they'll say, you know, it's you shouldn't have to work for someone like that. You know, who can you talk to about that? What can you do about it? And you're thinking, well, no one. You're right, you shouldn't have to work with someone like that. That's true, but that's life. And you are going to work with lots of rubbish bosses. And that's an awful thing to have to say, but it's true. Anybody who has a, you know, 20, 30, 40 year career in business is going to work with some pretty dreadful people, unfortunately. The skill is how do you navigate those people so they have the minimal impact on you and you're still able to keep moving yourself forward. Now, I know that sounds harsh and it sounds easy. It's not. I'm not saying it's easy to do it, but that's what I mean about this whole communication style of keeping people moving forwards, because it's about what can you control? What do you have influence over? What can you do? Stop wasting your focus and your energy on what someone else is doing, because yep. There's probably not much you can do about that.
Yeah, there's two aspects to that, isn't there? There's one from the coach perspective. It's your role is to help to empower and enable them to make that progress. From their perspective, it's about them taking responsibility and ownership of that to make the progress. You know, sometimes leaders, managers, coaches, whatever we want to call them, can fall into the trap of taking the responsibility on themselves to fix the problem. Here's what I would do if I was you. Now, there's the value of experience, mentorship, and all that sort of stuff in the past of, hey, I've been in a similar situation to this one from my understanding of what you've explained. Here's what I did in that scenario, if this would be of help to you. But even then, the experience won't be the same because we're coming at it through different lenses. So your experience of a similar problem to mine, we might come at it from completely different perspectives. So my solution may not solve that for you. You know, I might turn around and say, you have to leave. You know, that's what I did. I found that I just couldn't cope with that type of thing. So I left. You're sitting there going, that's just not even a solution. That was a waste of breath.
Yeah, it's. I mean, the word you used at the beginning is key to that, isn't it? It's responsibility or ownership. That's the difference. So if you look at any organization, the very best people, you know, we call them talent, whatever. The very best people in any organization will do one of two things. They'll make it work for them regardless. And the reason they do that is because they take ownership for themselves. So they may have the worst promotional, I don't know, HR pathways, just not a thing. Nobody thinks anywhere. They still find a way to get to wherever they get to because they'll take ownership for it or they'll leave. And that's, again, taking ownership for that decision because they'll go and do it somewhere else. That will always happen. So yes, we should be trying to put things in place to make that easier for people, to encourage people to do that, to support people in that, of course. But the difference between the people who do it and the people who don't quite do it is usually ownership. It's taking responsibility for that. And that can be sometimes, to your point, making a very difficult decision, but you're not going to wait for someone else to come and spoon feed that for you. You're going to make that and take that ownership there and then.
Okay, so what you just said there, really fascinating. So there's always top talent, right? There's always the people who stand out, whether it's the top salespeople who are always at the top. And then you'll always have that bottom quartile that seems to be the same bottom and they're sort of hanging on for dear life. But we have a big percentage of those people in the middle that are often classed as great potential. You know, they've got the potential to achieve more, do more, be even better. Is that the art of good leadership? Is that the art of good management? Is to enhance the people at the top who are always going to be at the top. But if we actually focus on and work on that, so that middle ground, that potential, and get them to see that, recognize that, and start to take that responsibility and ownership, that we actually start to lift the pile as a whole. Because if the middle starts to lift up, the top are going to want to stay the top anyway. So they're going to push themselves up harder and further. And the people at the bottom are either going to, they're going to be either out of there or they're going to cling on to the bottom somehow.
Yeah.
and lift.
I think it's, I mean, yeah, the whole performance management type conversation is a tricky one. I mean, from my perspective, I think the challenge with it is, and I get on my soapbox a little bit with this with clients, is being clear why and what buckets are you trying to put people into? So an obvious example of that is over the last decade that there's been a big change around, I think, is so many organizations talk about everyone is a leader. So it becomes one of their kind of behavioral framework criteria, one of their values, whatever it may be. Everyone is a leader. So if you think everybody should be a leader, your assessment in some way is around your leadership skills. I fundamentally disagree with that. And here's why. Because the difference between a leader and a manager is change. Right. What I mean by that is, and I could share definitions from the book and all day long, but in its simplest form, a leader's job is to evolve things, to change things. Now, in my view, that is always towards the future customer. That's something that startups and entrepreneurs do extremely well. Management is about maintaining. It's about, if you think of it as an analogy, think of it as a car. Management are there to keep the engine humming and as tuned and working as efficiently as possible. The leaders are there to keep that thing moving forwards to the next place. Once that's established, the management then pick it up and they'll, you know, they're the people ultimately, for instance, who will make sure the customers have a brilliant experience of the new process or product, whatever it may be. Some people are brilliant at doing the management bit and some people less good at the change bit and the kind of forward looking bit. If you put everyone into that bucket of change, it'll be complete chaos because you can't have an organization where everyone's trying to change things. It just doesn't work. But then everybody's thinking, hang on, I'm supposed to be being a leader, but actually that's not what I'm about. So therefore I get put in that, as you were describing, that sort of lower tier. And I'm being measured against something that isn't a criteria I'm even remotely interested in. So I think what we've got to do is be clear. The people at that middle management level who keep the engine humming are actually, I would say, the most important people in the organization, but they get none of the love. It's the leader bit that's always the glamorous, sexy, funky bit and everybody talks about. Actually, an organization that's got brilliant management and crap leadership will continue just fine as long as the market doesn't suddenly go off in a different direction or you don't have something like COVID happen. So obviously, post-COVID, you know, we've learned a lot from that. But the reason that happens is that it's that middle bunch of people are the people who are actually delivering the thing, the service, and keeping the customers happy.
Yeah.
The other way around, if you've got lots of leaders and not very many people actually doing the delivery, that company will fold in a year. because you've got lots of people second guessing and trying to change and, you know, ideas and innovation and da-da-da-da, but no one actually is delivering anything. So I think that companies have got to be clear, who do we need where? How do we reward them? Because it will be different. You know, I would reward somebody who I'm putting more into that leadership bucket in a very different way than somebody who probably has no career aspiration whatsoever to do that. They just really enjoy what they're doing. How do we ensure that they're continually evolving and developing in that realm?
Yeah.
And again, back to what I said at the very beginning, that holistic conversation, which very often doesn't happen, is understanding from the individual's perspective, to your point, Al, what do they want?
Yeah.
There's an awful lot of people who say, I don't want that thing I'm supposedly being measured and assessed against. It's not who I am. It's not where I want to go.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
Yeah. Well, it's that last little bit of your sentence there, that's okay. Because for years and years and years, there was a perception that's not okay. If you're not aspiring for the next role, the leadership role, the corner office, then you're either doing yourself a disservice or you're doing the business a disservice, because we should all be thriving and striving to achieve these great heights. Even from an entrepreneurial point of view, there's that sort of concept of once you've got something going, you should be working on the business, not in the business. Get off the tools as quickly as possible. But actually, there's a lot of people that go, no, it's being on the tools that I really enjoy. This is my passion. This is how I built this business, because I'm good at this. And I'd rather put somebody in around me or above me or beside me to take care of all of that, which I suppose links me to, tenuous link to, you mentioned obviously coming back, you had your executive coaching business and career, and then you also have co-founded a couple of other businesses, one of them being the Business Coaching Academy, BCA, mm-hmm. with a previous guest, Dean. So how does that work? Is that because you bring different things to the relationship, different skill sets, different ideas? Because again, you could look at it and go, well, you're both leaders in your own right, but there's some management that needs to be done and completion of. So how did you sit down and shape and create that to be the success that it's turned into?
For about 2.5 years, we got it completely wrong.
Okay.
And I think it's an important question, because I think part of making something work, and we're only small, you know, so we take that into account, but it is sometimes sitting down and just having those very honest conversations. Back to what we said earlier about what do you want? What's the bit that you want to drive and you feel you can really add value to? So I think once we've figured that out, it worked beautifully. So we're a complete yin and yang in terms of our styles. But, you know, we decided in terms of how the business goes forward, anything that's around, I guess, more the business development process, governance, et cetera, et cetera, side of things is Dean's bag. Anything that's around product development, more the creative innovation side, very much my cup of tea. And I think once you get your head around to that and you're prepared to actually then step back and just let someone get on with it, you know, complete trust to say, right, off you go. And then things start to get much, much easier. I mean, I get in a perfect world, that's great. I think when organizations get to a certain point where they're not quite big enough, to your point, that someone can step away from the tools. For instance, I mean, I in my role, I can't. I'm still probably half and half doing some of the delivery versus more the strategic stuff. That's quite hard. I think there is a tension there. So it is slightly determined by the size of the organization, I think.
Yeah, it's a needs must, isn't it? And again, like you said, it goes back to the, what do I need, but what does the business need? What does this relationship need? But there's one key takeaway from all of this is it comes back to that quality of communication. It's the ability to sit down with your business partner and turn around and say, what do you want? What do I want? Is this serving us the way that it's going at the moment? Are we both delivering it? And have those, for want of a better phrase, that grown-up conversation. So it's interesting to see how those type of things evolve, but I think it's also fascinating and really refreshing to hear you say, we got it wrong for a period of time. And, you know, it's only often in hindsight that we can do that. So looking back on the past, seeing where things are now, and then looking to the future, how have you seen things evolve? And how have you allowed things through all your experience and over time to strip away and discard the stuff that you start to go, that doesn't serve anymore, and keep the stuff that's of value in order to then take that forward into where we think things are going to go in the future? So there's a difference between something that is a core foundation and a principle that will always serve. You know, we still quote 7 Habits of Highly Effective People from 1989 because the principles of seek first to understand before being understood, begin with the end of mind, all that sort of stuff are great principles. But there's a lot of stuff that we hark back to from the 70s and 80s, or managers and leaders can, that actually you start to challenge and question and go,
I probably have a slightly controversial view on
that. Doesn't surprise me.
I think what served us well 2,000 years ago serves us just as well today. I think anybody who tells you that people have changed is trying to sell you something. I don't buy it. And I think if you look at, it's extraordinary how many books published today still quote, for instance, you know, the Greek philosophers of 2,000 years ago, right? Yeah. You know, your Aristotle's, whoever it may be. And I think that tells you something. So if you think about it in the context of, let's say, leadership, for instance, I think the DNA of great leadership is no different now than it was then. I think there's the nuances have shifted clearly, and some of the skills have kind of become more paramount, some less so. I think one of the difficulties we have now is that the study of leadership, historically, when you go right back, is much more in terms of the military side of it. Yes. As opposed to the business side of it. We don't really have a rich record of, you know, the really successful business people of their day. Or if we do, they were probably working in selling tobacco or slavery, you know, so something just very distasteful that we don't want to get involved in. Mm-hmm. So I think that's quite hard, but I think people haven't really changed. I mean, from an evolutionary sense, it takes an awfully long time for us to actually change. So I think in a coaching sense, you mentioned Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. That book, I think, is as relevant today as it was when it was first published, as an example. And I think you could think of others. So I think we want to continually evolve these things, but I think it's really dangerous where we sort of write them off because, well, that's 20 years old. That's past its sell-by date. It's no longer relevant. That's complete nonsense. The big thing for me that brings all that together is practical application. For me, that's the most important thing. So everything we do in terms of how we evolve, you've got, well, to this day to some extent, but 10 years ago, everything was talking about neuroscience. Again, I'm trying to sell you something. It's the same thing that someone was writing about 30 years ago, but now I can put the neuroscience label on it.
Yep.
Well, that must be interesting because that must be new thinking. Well, it isn't. We have a better understanding of the brain and how it works, but from a practical application point of view, nothing's changed. It really hasn't. Well-being, mindfulness, mental health, all of these things, big ticket industries, all great in their own right. But if you look at what's being done within them, that's the stuff that as coaches we were doing 25 years ago. You know, there's nothing necessarily new in that. So I think it's about that. Take what's being done, learn from it, but it's back to the practical application. Knowing and learning and reading a book on something is very different from understanding how do you actually therefore bring that to life.
Yes.
You know, knowing and doing are very different things.
Quote from Covey is to know and not to do is not to know.
Well, it's true though, isn't it? So I think with the academy, the big thing for us has always been to join the dots between the knowing and the doing. And it's the practical application side is okay, we can understand something, but do you therefore know how to bring that to life in that really difficult conversation with that person who's an absolute superstar and has had enough and they're thinking about walking out the door? You know, or whatever it may be. They're two very different things. I think in terms of where this is all going, clearly we want to have our eyes on things like artificial intelligence. I think that from a coaching point of view, from a learning point of view, that is absolutely fascinating. That will be huge. It's when we get to a point with the technology that, you know, we've looked into some of this from an academy point of view, but the tech isn't quite there yet to replicate, for instance, having a conversation with another human being in a very fluid way. But it's not far off, I think is really exciting. I think obviously virtual working has changed things to some extent. We've had to sort of reset slightly how we approach things. And I think there are opportunities from a virtual point of view that we didn't have when we were working face-to-face and vice versa. But that's about being adaptable, I think, really, and just kind of thinking through ways that you can exploit those opportunities better. But yeah, I know it's a bit of a broken record one, but for me, you could take the best-selling books of the last 20 years and there'd be some amazing stuff in all of them. That doesn't mean you're any good at doing it.
No, I agree. It goes back to your musician story. If we think back to the principles of years ago, the learning came through application. So it was an apprenticeship through to mastery and you learned how to do something from the very foundation and then built upon it as you progress through. And I agree with you entirely that because of the principle-based element, sometimes it's these new ways of telling the same idea. It's about stripping it down and going, so what's the lesson in there? And as a result of that, what am I going to do with it? So I'll throw in another contentious one for you to bat back at me then on the basis of that. So what would you say to people that would go, but I've got a few millennials in my team and I've got some boomers, so I've got to treat them all differently because millennials are like this and boomers have this sort of outlook and attitude to things. How do you deal with that when people are different?
I think, well, lots of different angles to that. I think the starting point for me, though, is your appetite to learn. You know, I think if you're, I mean, this is my 50th year, you know, I'm thinking if I'm 55 running, I don't know, let's say a big department in an organization, and suddenly someone says to me, you're going to have to completely adapt what you're doing to suit all of these, you know, these new younger people coming into the organization. Do I have the appetite to do it? Do I have the appetite to want to try and understand the world from their perspective? I think without that, you're going nowhere fast anyway. But for me, it's back to that conversation, back to that holistic approach to understand, well, what are their expectations? What's realistic? What's not? Is there a place where you can meet halfway around some of those things? So, I mean, there's tons of good stuff out there, isn't there, in terms of research around this. But there is some stats to reinforce this. Partly, I was going to say there is this myth. It's not really a myth, but this idea that this sort of sense of entitlement. So I'm in an organization. I'm 20 years old. I've been here for 6 months and I want to be promoted. Or I'm bored. I haven't actually delivered anything yet, right? I think if that is a reality to some extent. But part of that for me is managing expectations much, much further back before you get to that point, which takes you back to just having a better conversation. So we talk about in coaching, we talk about contracting, for instance. So contracting is managing expectations up front. And the expression I use is have the conversation before you need to have the conversation. So an example of that might be, I might say to you, so in 6 months' time, Al, you've just joined us, that's really exciting. In 6 months' time, when you come and tell me you're bored now and you'd like a promotion, what do I do? Because I've heard that might happen. You know, and I can play devil's advocate a bit. I'm not saying that's going to solve the problem, but a lot of people just aren't having those kind of conversations. They become very reactive to these situations rather than proactively kind of talking and getting this stuff out on the table initially to understand, okay, how do you see the world? Brilliant. Let me now tell you how I see the world. Let's see if we can meet in the middle somewhere. So that hopefully in 6 months' time, we're not having that slightly awkward, slightly weird conversation because we already kind of headed that one off at the pass 6 months previously.
Love that. And that's it, isn't it? Once again, it's meeting the people where they are, but it's about putting that stuff on the table and seeing, one, which bits they pick up and respond to. But it goes back to what you said earlier about, and then you can keep referencing that. It's this comes back to the time thing and all the rest of it. If you put that extra couple of minutes in there to have that conversation, later on, you're not going into a reactive, oh my God, I haven't got the time to really fix this. And so I'm just going to have to tell them because of those few minutes that you could have had previous to that. I think that's fantastic. Okay, so I've got to make reference to the fact that we've talked about all these great books out there that have lots of knowledge weaved throughout them and lots of stuff that you can apply, and you've got to look for the lessons and actually be able to do something to it. But fundamentally, there's some really good content in there, and you've added to the mix. But I want to talk to you a little bit about what the book's about and what drove you to actually want to add to the mix out there. But also, you didn't do it on your own. So again, how that relationship aspect of it works to bring it all together.
So thanks. Yeah, so the book is called Even Better If.
Have we mentioned that a couple of times, right?
Where that comes from, the title was very deliberate, because in my world around coaching, and when we talk about things like feedback and so on, we always try and encourage people to use the language of Even Better If. So you know, we've done something in a certain way, how do we make it even better? So you're always building on a positive rather than kind of necessarily going to a negative space. Well, that was rubbish. You need to stop doing that and start doing this instead. You know, that just doesn't land. It doesn't work with people. So that's where the title came from. How do we make ourselves, how do we make 2022, whatever it may be, even better? How do we, that continual thing I talked about, forward momentum, moving forward. So the book came about between myself and an organization called Scarlett Abbott, who I've worked with for a number of years and done a lot of performance coaching and consultancy with. And the founder of Scarlett Abbott, a lady called Rachel, and one of the other individuals who works within Scarlett Abbott, who's a behavioral scientist called Lindsay. And we got together a couple of years ago and we all kind of had a bit of a book in us, but to actually write a whole book, and you know, we didn't quite know what was going to come with COVID and all the rest of it, but it seemed like a pretty daunting challenge. And then actually when you think, well, actually, how about, could I write a third of a book? And it worked beautifully, because the whole thing we all agreed on was the frustration with any business book I've ever bought is the bit that's really useful and the bit it's sold on is covered usually in about 30 pages. But you end up with a book that's got 400 pages. And it's just ridiculous. And actually, so we said, well, you know what? We can just dilute down. So we have three chapters each, and we just really get to the nub of what are we trying to say? What are we trying to do in three chapters? So you'd have to spend ages kind of reading statistically, I know how, you know, the vast majority of people don't get past something like page 20, I think, when they buy a book. And so we, you know, that was very much the approach we wanted to take, which was just a brilliant opportunity. So the book is looking at sort of organizations, leadership and people. So there's hopefully there's something for everyone, from everything from, you know, talking about organizational purpose and change right the way through to things like, you know, psychological safety within the workplace. And my bit was leadership, because that's my passion. So to sit down and go, okay, you've got three chapters to write down everything you believe to be true about leadership. You know, how scary is that? But what a brilliant, brilliant exercise to have to go through. So in a nutshell, I created something that I believe to be very true around this concept that, for me, I think leadership is probably 85% attitudinal. It's about a mindset. Leaders think better than everybody else. So in a room 2 years ago, you know, Boris Johnson comes on and says, from Monday, everything stops. You know, and everybody sat in that boardroom or was looking at each other going, holy shit, everybody has to work from it. Everything stops. Some people panic. Some people want to hide under the desk. Some people kind of pretend it's going to go away. Some people deny it. But some people go, okay, that is really, really, really unprecedented and horrible and tough and awful. But what's the opportunity that it creates for us? And it's the thing that's different in the room is somebody is just seeing something through a different lens than everybody else, which becomes empowering and enables you to move forwards with it. That's the nub, the difference, I believe, in business, particularly of people that stand out from a leadership perspective versus everybody else. So that led me to say, okay, if I was to distill that down, and this is based on a lot of research and interviews and all the rest of it, and I came up with something called the God Principle. So it's a bit of a play on words around leaders being the gods. But the God Principle is three, I would think of them as being three mindset, three cognitive habits that anyone can develop. And they are, the G stands for growth, which is all about having a... The word visionary is quite grandiose, but seeing things better. Do you look at processes, people, teams, structures, whatever, and you see them and how they could be better? The O then is optimism. And optimism is not the same as positivity. Optimism is when things are really tough, I'm still able to see that glimmer of light, that glimmer of opportunity in the darkness, rather than faking some kind of positivity that everything's going to be fine, because it's incredibly artificial and people recognize it. People can smell fake positivity a mile away. Whereas optimism will enable you to move forwards because you are actually focused on something that can be done. It's very different. And then the D is disruption. And disruption is the bit which is the actual, I said earlier about the difference between leadership and management, and leadership being something to do with change. I think a leader's job is to continually disrupt with the view of evolving their team or their business to meet the needs of their future customer. So, you know, to improve is to change. So to change something requires an element of disruption. It could be a huge amount of disruption. It could be a small amount of disruption, but there's always disruption. Great leaders are disruptors, but they only ever disrupt to move forwards with the intention of growth. And if you put those three things together and they become habitual, they become part of your DNA, they just become part of how you show up. From a leadership point of view, you are off to the races.
Love that. Love that. Seriously, your passion came through. So it's obvious that it's part of you. It's part of your DNA and what's important to you. I love the challenge of, okay, everything that you believe to be true about leadership in three paragraphs. Go. I mean, that's disruption in itself.
I think, I mean, the big thing for me, Al, was, and many people would may well disagree with this, and that's absolutely fine. I mean, this is taken from many thousands and thousands of hours of, I mean, I do a lot of team coaching as well as individual coaching. And I do believe it's true. I mean, leaders just show up differently. Okay, so you say, well, what does that mean? That means in a room, the people who are the natural leaders, and you can't, I don't think anyone would disagree with this, they just stand out. There's just something about them. Okay, so what is that thing? Well, what that thing is they are thinking differently. So when they speak, when they communicate, when they behave, they come across as different because cognitively something different is going on. They're just seeing something in a different way, in a way that's maybe just more constructive, you know, or maybe more future focused or maybe more challenging. That's the difference. And this is why I believe very strongly, back to the old argument about, you know, are leaders born or made? Anyone can be a leader if you want to do it, if you have the appetite to do it. But back to our earlier conversation, you don't have to be. It's okay not to be, because you're still just as valuable, but in a different way.
And again, it goes back to, there's a difference between I would love to be a leader and therefore put the work in, or I love the idea of being a leader because it seems to have the trappings of the acknowledgement and the rewards and the recognition and the various bits and pieces. You've got to put the work in.
It's bloody hard, it's lonely, and it will make you unpopular.
but other than that, put that
on a job description. It is true, though. You know, I mean, the reason cliches are cliches is because there's truth in them. That's why they survive. And it's saying it's lonely at the top. Absolutely. Well, there's a reason why.
Yeah, well, as you say, that's where they talk about the top 1%, right? So they're out there on their own for that reason. So all that's left for me to say today is that thanks ever so much for your time. I wish you all the continued success that you deserve.
Thank you, Al. It's been an absolute pleasure. I've enjoyed it.
Well, I really enjoyed that too, and I hope you feel the same. For me, I loved our conversation around the value of being interested in others and their views and the ability to explore and understand them, about the importance of staying curious. Of course, there was also the discussion around the quality of your questions, how coaching and leadership is ultimately about communication, how you should look to work with people holistically as they are more than just their job title, about the power of responsibility and ownership and how that will make you stand apart. And the classic example is not using time as an excuse, but learning how to use it effectively and invest it wisely by having the right conversations at the right time. So a big thanks to Charlie Sampson. If you want to know more about Charlie, then head over to sampsoncoaching.co.uk or find the Business Coaching Academy via thebcacademy.co.uk, and you'll see a lot more of the topics that we discussed here today. Okay, so thanks again to you for taking the time to listen to some Infinite Pi Thinking and the stories that make a difference. I hope you took a lot from this and the other conversations I've had with some remarkable people. I'd love to hear what you think and the action that you've taken. So reach out to me on LinkedIn or via Instagram or, of course, infinitepi.co.uk. I'd love to hear your stories.